Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. Cool out there. Going to get up into the 70s. Going to see plenty of sunshine over the next 2 days. No weather to worry about until Saturday.
And the humidity is down.
Yeah. Let's have a golf tournament. You know anybody, Jamie?
156 of my closest PGA friends.
There you go.
Let's go.
We knew we could depend on you.
Yeah.
Yes, it's round one of the Rocket Mortgage Classic out of Detroit Golf Club. They got a great day, and it's going to be a great event. Get out there and see them. It's we've got a 15-year-old, Miles, who's going to be out there and hitting the ball and amazing all of us. We'll wait to see what he does. It has been a busy night at the Capitol in Lansing, a lot of late-night wrangling. They got a budget passed. I'm going to give you details of it in a moment, but first, the first step toward justice in the murder of Deputy Bradley Reckling.
Yeah, 18-year-old Clinton Township resident Kareem Blake Moore has been charged in connection to the murder of Oakland County Sheriff Deputy Bradley Reckling. Moore was arraigned yesterday on 3 counts of lying to a peace officer and 1 count of resisting arrest. Deputy Reckling, a 9-year veteran, was fatally shot on Saturday night while investigating a stolen vehicle. He was behind the stolen Chevrolet Equinox on Detroit's east side when the suspects opened fire, hitting him in the head and chest. Using a dog track, police located the suspects nearby and found 2 guns and gloves along the path. Now, during interrogation, Moore admitted to being in the stolen vehicle but denied firing the shot, citing fear for his safety. Oakland County Sheriff Mike Bouchard called the incident an ambush. Wayne County Assistant Prosecutor Matthew Perry told the judge yesterday why he wanted a high bond for Moore.
This is a man with a flight risk. He is in the thick of something that is very deep and very, very serious. He chose to, by his own account, after seeing police lights, ran from the vehicle, ran with 2 others who were apparently involved, ran 3 blocks away from the scene where the officer unfortunately expired, and it resulted in a dog track finding them within a relatively short period of time on a porch that they didn't belong on.
Now, Moore's bond has been set at $100,000 cash, no 10%, with a hearing scheduled for Friday. Reckling leaves behind a pregnant wife and 3 daughters. A GoFundMe and a Mission Oakland Fund have been set up to support the family. A vigil at Romeo High, where Reckling graduated in 2012, saw hundreds gather to honor him. Visitation and funeral services held this Friday at 10 a.m. It'll be at the Apostolic Church in Auburn Hills.
So the prosecutor said by his own account, which means the suspect is talking, but not talking much. And what do we know about this major auto theft ring? I mean, who are they working for?
Because they have to be
18-year-old punks, as you pointed out.
No, yeah, no, absolutely not. And I think more investigation is happening behind the scenes on that as well.
Because they were working for somebody.
They had to be working for someone. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting day for the Supreme Court. Decisions they released, decisions they didn't mean to release.
So let's talk about what they didn't mean to release. They acknowledged they accidentally uploaded a version of their abortion case and then took it down after that. But Bloomberg found it and posted it everywhere. The Supreme Court, it looks like, is going to allow abortions in medical emergencies in Idaho, according to a copy that was briefly posted online. 6-3 majority would reinstate a lower court order that ensured hospitals in the state could perform these emergency abortions to protect the health of the mother. In the final ruling of the case, if it mirrors that document, it would be the second time in as many weeks this court has pivoted away from limiting reproductive rights. You remember mifepristone and that. However,
there was really a punt.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote in the Post filing that the decision is not really a victory for pregnant patients in Idaho. It's a delay.
Right.
Yeah.
They found that the petitioners did not have standing. And here's my question. Isn't that something you do when you decide whether you're going to take up the case or
right.
not?
Right. Right.
Could they have already sent it back saying, you don't have standing.
Not wasted.
We're not hearing it.
Right.
We're hearing a lot. This is not the first time,
deciding not to decide is not a decision.
Exactly.
And that's kind of the case in this free speech. Murthy versus Missouri, the Supreme
Social Media.
Yeah, the social media free speech. The Supreme Court threw out this challenge to government efforts to have social media companies remove posts if it's considered misinformation. This is Justice Amy Coney Barrett writing for the majority, and she said that the challengers argued that unfettered speech on social media is critical to their work as scientists, pundits, activists. Quote, but they don't point to any specific instance of content moderation that caused them indefinable harm. They have therefore failed to establish an injury that is sufficiently concrete and particularized. So
they have no standing.
Right. And so some people are saying that this is disappointing because the high court didn't provide more guidance on these limits that the First Amendment places on government's pressure campaigns. In dissent, it was Alito, Gorsuch, and Clarence Thomas.
This is so important. When the government puts their thumb on the social media scale, it's a big, fat thumb. And it has the ability to change the dialogue on important issues. You need to decide on that.
And instead, they just said these people weren't injured, therefore... Mm-hmm.
They have no standing, and so we're not going to deal with that.
Well, we'll await what non-decisions they release today. we could think about it now. We could get an immunity decision today ahead of the debate.
Now, wouldn't that just,
doesn't that kind
blow
of
it
change things? It
changes the conversation tonight.
Yeah,
it does.
If they grant some immunity to former President Trump, that's open field running for him to say to Joe Biden, you have weaponized the legal system, and the Supreme Court just said so.
Yeah.
It's going to make an interesting night even more interesting. At 4:30 this morning, the legislature was still at work. They passed a new budget. We're going to get to the budget part, but the things that will affect us the most, they extended unemployment from 20 to 26 weeks. This is the kind of thing you normally do when you're in a recession, not when you're at full employment, not when you have 1.5 jobs out there for every unemployed person.
Yeah, they can't find enough people.
You just increase the cost of doing business on every small business person in the state of Michigan, almost in some ways maybe guaranteeing you're going to have more unemployment.
Right.
And when asked about how much this is going to cost, Karen Whitsitt, who was the Democrat from Detroit that proposed it, couldn't say. She didn't know. But
where is the need for this?
Thank you. It's the right thing to do, she says. It's common sense. She also wants to raise the monthly or the weekly stipend from $362 to somewhere around $600. Again, that's you're going to start punishing job creators and employers. Now, they also passed a bipartisan bill that will enhance our prenatal and postpartum care for pregnant women here in the state of Michigan. This is kind of like burying the lead of what they did today. Mm-hmm. That's going to be huge for a lot of women, especially low-income women, and the babies that we see with bad outcomes that could have been prevented. And that's kind of the little nugget there that's the ray of sunshine. Now, on the $83 billion budget, they did not increase the amount of K-12 spending. Instead, they're going to allow districts to forego or shrink some of their pension expenditures so that they have more money in their pockets for teachers. Superintendents say that's not what we need. We don't need a one-time budget gimmick. We need long-term spending strategies that are going to enhance outcomes here. They think it's going to lead to layoffs. We're going to be talking with one of those administrators a little bit later on because they're good and upset about it. The Taylor Swift bill passed the Michigan House. FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, putting the governor and the legislature under that, passed the Senate. The Senate leaders, Ed McBroom, who is one of my favorite guys when it comes to this issue, says, yeah, it's not what we hope for, but it's better than nothing. Well, it still is nothing because the House is adjourning without acting on it. Mm-hmm. Are they going to pass it before an election? We'll see. Mm-hmm. I doubt it. Mm-hmm. That's where we are when it comes to Lansing.
What about the Pistons? What did they take yesterday? They took fifth pick yesterday. Who did they get yesterday?
They did. They took a G League.
And will we know his name even after you tell
us? Well, you clearly don't already. Ron Holland, the second, was picked fifth in the draft. And
because Ron Holland, the first, wasn't available?
Yeah.
Really quickly, Parker, let's just hear from the pick.
That comes from my family. Growing up, I grew up around a competitive family, super, super competitive on my uncle's side. Really just a lot of competing with anything when it comes to playing basketball, going in the street to race, and I think that just that was built into my family and that was built instilled in me, and then that has carried me throughout my whole journey.
So apparently high energy guy,
yeah,
but
tough. He's a forward.
But he needs shooting help. And the Pistons overall need shooting help. So that was the criticism online yesterday.
He's 6'7", 206. If he wants to come into my house, Gail can fatten that young man up.
He's only 18, too. So
what's
he's
that?
Got, he's only 18 years old.
He's got room to grow. And,
the Pistons believe the coaching staff they brought in could help him. So.
Exactly. And this is Trey's first pick.
Trajan Langdon's first pick.
Mm-hmm. All right. It is 6:15. Lots to get to on a very busy Thursday morning. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the debate tonight with Ryan Schmelz, live from Capitol Hill on JR Morning.
Well, tonight all eyes are on Atlanta as the presidential debate takes center stage. President Biden is in intense preparation mode at Camp David with his team of advisors, while the former president, Donald Trump, shared in a podcast interview that he's readying himself for tonight's CNN debate by taking questions and attending events. Well, let's get some insights and analysis on this. We bring in Ryan Smells, Fox News radio correspondent and WJR contributor, who is on the JR Morning Live line. Ryan, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys.
So it is so much going on with this preparation. You got Biden, his people outfitting places, spaces in Camp David, like a movie theater and an airplane hangar for debate prep. You got Trump, who's opted for a kind of more informal approach to his debate prep. What are we going to see tonight?
Well, it's going to be hard to know. I think, you know, based off of what we heard from Republicans and Democrats yesterday, Dem leadership's expecting President Biden to focus on abortion, or at least that to be one of the big issues, and to make Donald Trump defend his nominations for the Supreme Court and issues like the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And President Biden's ultimately going to probably try to blame former President Trump for the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So I would expect that to be a big focus there. And I think the other big focus we're going to see is former President Trump zoning in on the inflation and the economy, and also focusing on border security. And it's not shocking that these two candidates are going to focus on these issues, because, you know, when you poll Republican and Democrat voters, Republicans oftentimes their second biggest issue behind the economy is usually border security. And for Democrats, it appears that abortion is a winning issue for them, not just on the polling data, but because of what you saw with the midterms last election cycle.
On border security, though, Donald Trump coming into this debate has a really vivid story to tell about this 12-year-old girl, Jocelyn Ungari, in Houston, Texas, who was killed by two illegals from Venezuela. He can make her the poster child of this border security issue. And do you think we're going to see him do what was done during the State of the Union, where he's going to say to Biden, say her name?
Oh, I wouldn't be shocked at all. I think that's definitely going to be something that happens. And, you know, we were talking to some Democrats yesterday. There was one who pointed out that what he wants President Biden to do when it comes to the issue of immigration is that he wants President Biden to focus on the amount of times that maybe bills that had additional resources for the Department of Homeland Security, different solutions to the border were shot down by Republicans, right, or even shot down by former President Trump. So that was one thing we heard from Democrats yesterday when it comes to the issue on border, is for President Biden to focus on some of the stonewalling that you've seen in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, and try to blame that on Republicans.
Well, and Republicans kind of gave him that.
You can make that argument.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, former President Trump did not like the border bill. He encouraged people to take it down when it was negotiated by James Lankford. And, you know, Lankford to this day is still defending it. We talked to him last week. And you can even see some of the interview on my Twitter account. You know, he still is very much defending his decision to try and come up with a solution. And, you know, Lankford was a long time considered to be a hardline conservative. So, you know, this is going to be something that I think Biden does focus on tonight.
Ryan, how might Michigan present itself in this debate? The talk of EVs?
Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked at all. You know, climate change is a big part of the President Biden's agenda. You know, he passed what was called the Inflation Reduction Act, which was supposed to gear up and accelerate the making of electric vehicles, or at least provide more resources for that. And I think, you know, President Trump might focus in on the lack of sales that have happened when it comes to EVs, or some of the other things that have halted the progress of President Biden's climate agenda. So I wouldn't be shocked at all, because especially with gas prices being so high right now, I think there's going to be a big debate. And I think both of these men are going to try to prove that they had the better record on issues like manufacturing, because there are a lot of stats out there, and, you know, they can be swayed and manipulated either way to see who is the better president on this issue. So I am curious to see how these two defend their records on the economy.
It will be very interesting, because one of the things we've seen is that Democrats, by a 2-to-1 margin, believes that inflation is the cause of greedy corporations. By a 2-to-1 margin, Republicans believe that it's because government spends too much, borrows too much, and racks up the deficits and debt. Any first-year economist would tell you the Republicans are right, but in the upside-down world, the Democrats have bought into that argument. Will President Trump be able to fact-check that in real time?
That's going to be hard to know. You know, I'm not quite sure President Trump has been known for having a ridiculous amount of numbers off the top of his head or bringing up issues like that. But, you know, it could be something that he may have and might be ready to utilize tonight. But we'll have to wait and see.
Well, you know, CNN has already told us that, you know, they'll have this double box and, you know, the debate format, no live audience and muted microphones. And so, you know, you'll see both of them and one person will be talking. The other person won't be able to say anything because the mic will be off. But I got to imagine that it's probably going to be a lot of sign language tonight, too.
Are they taking mime lessons?
Yeah. We'll see. I don't know what President Trump and President Biden's hand gesture skills are in terms of when they're not able to speak. Obviously, President Trump's got a very colorful hand motion whenever he is talking. But, you know, is he going to use that to communicate when his microphone's turned off? We'll wait and see.
Is there a plan for people in Washington to gather together and watch this debate?
I've heard of a couple watch parties, yes.
Could we just suggest?
Wow, that'll be a hoot.
One of our colleagues suggested that both candidates just need to learn two letters in American Sign Language, B and
yeah.
S.
Yeah.
And they can just nonverbally send that message when they're instead of the lip flap when they're in the two box. And because the moderators supposedly are going to step back, that doesn't mean that the Trump campaign isn't saying that they're already it's a 3-on-1 matchup.
Yeah, well, and the muted microphone is something that we expected to stay, especially if it was going to be these two again, because you saw how off the rails the first debate they had 4 years ago was. So, and then you saw when they brought back when they used the ability to mute the microphones at the next debate, it was a lot smoother and a lot more substantive. So it's not a shocker to see that be something that's being utilized. But I will say one more thing that's interesting too is. You know, we've had at least a couple of Republicans and Democrats, you know, say to us that, you know, they have a similar strategy, or at least they want their candidate to have a similar strategy and a piece of advice that they're giving them. And that is let the other person talk, because the thought is that if former President Trump gets Biden to do most of the talking, then ultimately he's going to have to prove that he is fit to be president, that his age is not going to be an issue. And then, you know, he could get off on tangents that come off as awkward. And then, you know, on the other hand, you know, I think President Biden's team has the thought that if they put former President Trump on the spot, there's a good chance that he loses his focus and goes off on his grievances about, you know, the 2020 election, about some of the criminal cases against him, and he kind of loses his focus. And I think that's also been a piece of advice Republicans keep giving to former President Trump, which is stay focused on the issues and keep it that way.
All right. Ryan Smells, Fox News radio correspondent, WJR contributor. Thank you so much for being here on JR Morning.
Of course. Thank you.
It was a late night for lawmakers, or rather an early morning, as they finally put those final votes on the $83 million state budget at like 5 a.m. We're joined by Sarah Leitner, state representative from Springport and the minority vice chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Good morning. Or is it still your night?
It's still night, but I'm in my pajamas now, so all will be right with the world.
As soon as you hang up here. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
We appreciate that.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about this new approach to K-12 dollars and taking them from retirement systems and moving them to free up dollars into classrooms. How did this come about?
Well, this was an interpretation by the Office of Retirement Services, you know, saying that MIPSTERS basically had two parts to it. One was the OPEB, which is like the health side, and then the pension side. Well, we continue to argue that it is one fund. It's got over $30 billion in liabilities still outstanding. ORS said, well, yeah, that's true, but you have the healthcare side, and the healthcare side's fully funded, and so, you know, you don't have to make that payment to that side. But current law, you know, says that we continue making the payment year after year. It just pays the debt off faster. And so under the budget that was passed this morning, they did utilize a lot of that money and, you know, put it into school aid. but it didn't come in the form of actual dollars per pupil. So it you know, it's a little, I think, disingenuous to say that, you know, it's helping out a lot, because it's not, and it's not sustainable. You know, we already have a downfall in school aid fund, and, you know, they're still funding all these other things, and then not funding like mental health and school safety, which is a huge priority for all of us, you know, because we want our kids to feel safe and be safe at school, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, last year that was funded at like $326 million, roughly. And this year it's about $25 or $26 million.
So, like, charter schools,
school safety.
Charter schools are set to receive like $50 million in per pupil funding, a boost of $50 million per pupil funding under this budget. But traditional public schools, they face those constraints. What's the potential implications?
Well, that, the difference between the charters is because the charters don't have the MIPSers. So they were given an allowance, I guess, is how I'm going to say it, you know, to fund them at the level that they were funded last year. You know, schools all got an increase last year, and this is the first year that schools don't get a per pupil foundation allowance increase in since like 2011.
I've got to ask you about this other element that came up, which is the House voted to extend unemployment from 20 to 26 weeks. We're not in a recession. We have 1.5 jobs for every unemployed person out there. Why are we extending unemployment and putting that burden on small businesses?
Sure. Well, that was a party line vote as well. And you may recall during COVID, we also voted to cut those off. And a lot of us who've owned businesses before, you know, tried to explain that fund isn't government funded. It's funded by the employers.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's hard to get people to understand that have never signed, you know, the bottom of a paycheck before, you know, writing them out.
What about this idea of enhancement grants and all the money going to about 100 projects across the state? When you're voting on this, do you know where all that money is going?
$334 million.
Yeah, you find out about it last minute. And that's just the enhancement grants that were listed in the LEO budget. There are actually other projects within the budget. As we were reviewing early this morning, we found other projects, you know, because there could be road projects in transportation or, you know, there's multiple projects all over. Those were just the enhancement grants. I think, you know, basically those were used to get yes votes on the budget.
So it's pork.
It is.
Okay, because we're talking Potter Park Zoo, which is a Lansing, the Lansing Zoo. WDET.
Lansing got a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Lugnuts Stadium, Jimmy John Stadium in Utica.
Some sports facility in Shelby Township.
These are
million.
In many cases, some not public goods. They're private enterprises
That are
getting.
And you see all these extra projects in the budget, and then you also see that there was no additional local road funding. You know, we've been talking about this for years, trying to implement, you know, additional road funding to, you know, make it a Michigan more accessible, I guess, you know, so you're not driving on crumbling roads. And none of that is put in place. And, you know, in our conversations at one point with one of the other members, not the ranking member on the Dem side for probes, but another member, they basically said that, well, we don't have enough money to do any real good for the roads right now, so we're going to spend it on these other things. And so, you know, they're funding these other projects that are funding e-bikes, urban bus transportation, you know, things like that, drone technology. Then they, you know, throw in, I don't know if you guys caught this, but there's a $10 million appropriation in there to, you know, figure out how to throw a birthday party for the state of Michigan for the 250th anniversary of the state of Michigan.
Which is something that private donors could have handled.
Absolutely.
Right? That's something that I'm sure there are a lot of, you could do that through corporate sponsorships.
Sure.
Well, and here's the other problem, Rep. Leitner, is that we don't know who is signing these appropriation requests. We don't have the sunshine laws here, right? Now, the Senate passed a sunshine thing yesterday. It puts the governor and the legislature on kind of a modified
under FOIA
Freedom of Information Act requirement. It's not the best, but it's something. Will we ever have the chance to see you folks in the House vote on that?
Well, how are ironic that they voted on that yesterday. You know, because one of the things we ask for and negotiate for is more transparency, reporting, you know, performance metrics. None of those things were in the budget. Usually that's in boilerplate, and none of those items were honored in this budget.
Well, I think you deserve some rest, and then you'll get back to work looking at each line item. Sarah Leitner, a Republican from Springport, and also the Minority Vice Chair of the House Appropriations Committee, thank you for your time this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to, you know, actually reading the 1,000 pages.
So. That sounds
I guess
really
it's a Nancy Pelosi approach, you know, you got to vote on it and see what's in it.
You got to laugh because other than that, you're just going to pull
gonna
your hair out.
Yeah. All right, yeah. Anyway, thank you, Representative from Springport.
Great. Thanks.
And her jammies.
Yeah, in her jammies. And the reporters, you know, they were there till 5 a.m.
Mauger was digging in the fine print there.
Exactly.
And good on him to come up with a lot of these numbers. And there's a lot more to
unpack. Yeah. Coming up, the Supreme Court made a decision when it comes to social media companies, the government, First Amendment. We're going to talk to someone from the Michigan State University First Amendment Clinic. Reaction at 6:49.
Now, we want you to win a trip to see the Eagles at the Sphere in Las Vegas. I mean, a legendary band in what is becoming one of the most unique venues around. They're doing 16 shows from September 20th through the December 14th. They've actually extended this. And we want to send you there. We got two trips for two. We've got the flights. We've got the room at the Venetian Resort in Las Vegas. We got dinner at Chica, Las Vegas. Two tickets to the show plus Vibe VIP experience package. But you need to know the national keyword to make yourself eligible for this. And the keyword this hour is limit. We want you to take it to the limit by texting that word to 95819. That's 95819. For full details and official contest rules, visit WJR.com.
The Supreme Court made a decision yesterday throwing out a challenge to government efforts to have social media companies remove posts if it considered it misinformation. And it was a 6-3 decision led by Justice Amy Coney Barrett. And basically, she said, writing for the majority, that they didn't prove that they had indefinable harm. Like, they didn't prove that they were harmed by this. And
therefore,
so,
they didn't have standing.
Right. So they just move on from this case. What does it mean moving forward when it comes to First Amendment limits? Let's ask Nancy Costello, professor of law at Michigan State University and director of the Michigan State University First Amendment Clinic. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
What do you take from Murthy versus Missouri when, you know, they didn't exactly define First Amendment limits?
Well, I don't think there is a lot we can take from it because the Supreme Court essentially did not make any kind of decisive ruling on the First Amendment free speech protections of people using the internet, posting on the internet, posting on social media sites. It was very specific to this case. The decision basically said that these particular plaintiffs, which were two states, Louisiana and Missouri, and three different plaintiffs, I think, and one of which, one of the plaintiffs included the founder of a far-right conspiracy website, basically saying these five plaintiffs simply couldn't show that they were harmed by the government's actions here. And the government's actions were members of the Biden administration were talking to social media companies and suggesting that they remove content or don't that was posted that had to do with this was really focused on around the COVID-19 epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And the disinformation that was being posted on different websites about this, things like that the perhaps how harmful the vaccines could be, the spread of COVID-19, et cetera. There was a lot of misinformation about this out there. And the Biden administration was believed that this was posing a public health hazard. And of course, we know that COVID had shut the country down economically, socially, et cetera. And so the longer this misinformation, disinformation was out there and people were not getting the proper protections or perhaps getting the vaccines, that this was really damaging to the country. So that's why they were talking to the social media sites. But the social media sites made the decision of what they were going to do about the content. It wasn't the government actually shutting down the content. They were talking to the social media companies about it.
But
companies made the decision.
When the federal government puts their thumb on the scale, it's not really a thumb, it's the whole leg. I mean, come on. When they do that, they're not like other people or other entities exercising their First Amendment. They have the ability to punish those social media companies with regulations, higher taxes, whatever. So we need a reckoning on that at some point about what the federal government's role should be.
But we didn't see those higher taxes. We didn't see those penalties.
Well, in a legal matter, no. But I mean, in speaking in theory here, we need to at some point find out where the guardrails need to be, don't we?
So one of the things that was also brought out as evidence in this case was that the social media companies had already started both to discuss removing this information, but also they had started removing it themselves.
And Amy Coney Barrett basically said you're putting the cart before the horse here?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, essentially, yeah. So while an interesting ruling, and for, at this juncture, conservative voices might see this as a defeat. Really, it's a very specific, it's only really specific to this case. Because the Supreme Court didn't make any, didn't pass any kind of dictum here on how free speech rights apply or don't apply in this situation.
So, Professor, how do you think this ruling is going to shape discussions and legal challenges surrounding digital rights and free speech in the future moving forward?
I think it depends on the case that comes before the Supreme Court. I think they essentially sort of sidestepped this whole issue. And it's not unusual. The Supreme Court will do that. I do think that one of the things that was interesting about this was that the opinion was written by Amy Coney Barrett, and she is sort of a darling of the conservative voices. A lot of conservatives had hoped that in her appointment by President Trump, that they would have had more power on the Supreme Court. And Amy Coney Barrett was one of the six justices to say that, no, this case doesn't hold water here and it's not going forward. And so that might be something of a disappointment.
Nancy, you think there are some other cases that could help define government's role more so than the case we just discussed? And these are NetChoice v. Paxton and Moody v. NetChoice?
Yes, those cases, we haven't yet gotten a decision on that case yet. Those cases, and that could happen any day now. Those two cases one was out of Florida, one was out of Texas, and essentially involved challenges to laws in these states that would regulate how and when social media companies could moderate their content and require companies to be transparent about the practices. NetChoice, notably, it's a coalition of social media companies and internet platforms that challenge the laws, claiming that they violate the big tech companies' free speech rights. And these laws were largely a reaction to X, or formerly Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube suspending Donald Trump from their sites and removing content posted by conservative voices following the January 6th attack on the nation's capital.
So you believe in this instance the Supreme Court won't be able to sidestep and we'll get some sort of guide rail in 30 seconds?
I will never tell you that. The Supreme Court often sidesteps and punts when it can, but this is another opportunity for them to make a ruling to decide. It has to sort out, it could sort out what practices by social media companies are expressive conduct protected by the First Amendment and what is non-expressive and could be regulated by the states. It poses that issue to them, and we'll see what they do with it.
We'll wait and see. Nancy Costello, professor of law at MSU and the Michigan State University First Amendment Clinic director, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, how we'll honor Deputy Reckling and what's the latest in the investigation into his death. That's next.
Happy Thursday to you. We're going to get on the couch with Dr. Steve Craig coming up at 7:19. They're teeing it up at the Rocket Mortgage. They've probably talked to all of their sports psychologists, too, before they get out there.
Sometimes I think I need a sports psychologist on the golf course, personally.
You know, we all may need to get on the couch after this debate tonight.
Oh, yes.
Or at least some kind of a cleanse of some kind. It's going to be interesting. And it's I never agree with Hillary Clinton on anything, but she said tonight we're being asked not to choose the best individual for the presidency. We're being asked to choose best actor, as if we were the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Because they're going to be acting. Biden is going to be trying to act like the ravages of age have not harmed him at all. Mm-hmm. And President Trump's going to try to act like he's presidential and reasonable and not the guy that we see on the rally stage.
Well, depending on how prep went, I think anyone can do something for 90 minutes. It's what you believe they can do for the next 4 years.
Right. And whether you believe the performance tonight really changes or should change your perception of them based on volumes of other data that you've accumulated as an informed citizen.
And
you've been paying attention.
The Supreme Court could throw a monkey wrench into this if they
rule
on immunity today.
Yeah. They could give Donald Trump a big hammer.
Yes.
Coming and saying, you weaponized the legal system against me and the Supreme Court just told you so.
Yeah.
I'm sure President Biden will have a ready answer
for
that.
Yeah.
And we were talking earlier, in this upside-down world that we're in, comes Axios with an interesting Harris poll showing that most Democrats do not believe that inflation is caused by excessive government spending or too many dollars chasing too few goods, which is the classic definition that every first-year economics student is taught in college. No, they believe it's corporate greed because that's what their leaders have sold them. So basically what they have done is they've said, yeah, you don't bear any responsibility for this as an elected leader. It's all those greedy corporations. Which means we're going to get more deficits, more debt, and more inflation if you're in that kind of denial.
I just can't get over these budget negotiations until 5 a.m. in Michigan and how they extended the unemployment benefits.
By the way, folks, they spent $83 billion of your dollars while you were sleeping.
Yes. And some were in their jammies.
That's right. Yeah, we had a great discussion with Sarah Leitner, who is the vice chair of the Appropriations Committee, the ranking Republican on it. And she was in her jammies because they didn't have the vote until 4:30 this morning.
I appreciated her candor
in
her jammies.
I appreciated her staying up to tell us the story.
And
the foundation grant, which stand behind every public school child in the state, will not be going up because they didn't increase the appropriation for the K-12 budget. It actually shrunk a bit, but they're going to do some budgetary nonsense with the pensions to free up about $500 million for local school districts that won't have to pay into the fund as much.
What does that mean for jobs?
What it means for jobs in the district, according to the Superintendents Association, is they're going to have to make more layoffs, they believe, because this is a one-time gimmick. And what they say they need is long-term funding sustainability.
Yeah.
But I'm going to ask the Flat Rock superintendent at 819 this, because I think Dr. Vedia said this. Could these dollars be more freeing, though, than the per-pupil funding? Could they use it on other things? That's my question.
I suppose it might give superintendents more leeway in how to spend those dollars, because those dollars is money that they won't be spending.
Right.
So there may be more latitude. But he would also say, we not only need more money, we need it going to districts that have greater need. There's an equity issue there as well. Also overnight, or I should say late yesterday, they passed a prenatal and postpartum health bill. People that say they're pro-life, you know what? This is a real pro-life bill.
It is.
This will help mothers have healthier babies. And you know, I work a lot with the March of Dimes with the golf outing.
Prenatal is important.
Oh my goodness.
What you do while you're pregnant is so important.
And if this gets more, especially low-income women, in to see a doctor ahead of birth to spotlight maybe some nutritional issues, some early diabetes
vitamins, things
like that, that could really lead to much better outcomes for the smallest among us.
Mm-hmm.
And good on, that was something that was bipartisan, and heavens to Betsy, shouldn't it be?
Yeah, 100%.
18-year-old Clinton Township resident Kareem Blake Moore. He's been charged in connection with the murder of Oakland County Sheriff Deputy Bradley Reckling. Moore was arraigned yesterday on 3 counts of lying to a peace officer and 1 count of resisting arrest. Now, Deputy Reckling, a 9-year veteran, was fatally shot on Saturday night while investigating a stolen vehicle. He was behind the stolen Chevrolet Equinox on Detroit's east side when the suspects got out, opened fire, hitting him in the head and chest. Using a dog track, police located the suspects nearby, found 2 guns and gloves along the path. During interrogation, Moore admitted to being in the stolen vehicle, but he denied firing the shots. He's citing fear for his safety. He says he doesn't want to deal with the neighborhoods once he comes out of prison, so he's not really talking much. Oakland County Sheriff Mike Bouchard called the incident an ambush. Wayne County Assistant Prosecutor Matthew Perry telling the judge why he wanted a high bond for Moore.
This is a man with a flight risk. He is in the thick of something that is very deep and very, very serious. He chose to, by his own account, after seeing police lights, ran from the vehicle, ran with 2 others who were apparently involved, ran 3 blocks away from the scene where the officer unfortunately expired. And it resulted in a dog track finding them within a relatively short period of time on a porch that they didn't belong on.
So his bond, Moore's bond, set at $100,000 cash, no 10%. Hearing scheduled for this Friday.
And here's to hoping some judge doesn't knock that bond down.
Oh, let's not.
Which is what happened in the case of the 2 other
That's
suspects.
Right.
Their bond was knocked down.
Yes.
And they were free on bond when they allegedly committed this act very quickly. The Pistons have picked up a diamond in a rough, I guess you would call him, in the 5th pick.
Ron Holland is his name with the number 5 pick. Let's listen to Adam Silver.
With the 5th pick in the 2024 NBA draft, the Detroit Pistons select Ron Holland II from Dallas, Texas, and the NBA G League's team Ignite.
Holland said he didn't expect to go to Detroit. It was a surprise to them. They didn't really talk to him. They didn't work him out. But Trajan Langdon said that was their mission because they wanted him. So they kept it close to the vest.
Apparently, he's a tough competitor.
High upside, athletic, energetic.
But 6'7", 206 pounds. We need to put some meat on that lad.
Yeah, and work on some shooting.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Time for WJR Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Let's check in with Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of Startup Nation.
Innovation is at the heart of many of the most promising startups. And since 2008, Fast Company, the entrepreneurial publication and media platform, has created an annual listing known as Fast Company's Most Innovative Companies. And this listing has become a go-to source for identifying and recognizing businesses that are transforming their industries and even reshaping society at large. That across diverse sectors such as design, consumer electronics, human resources, and of course, artificial intelligence, just to name a few. If you feel that your company is one which is fast-growing, remaking your industry, and changing the world for the better, this listing opportunity is for you. And the applications for the 2025 list have just opened. Each and every winner will receive more value than ever offered previously. That includes a feature in Fast Company's March-April 2025 issue, a profile page on fastcompany.com, and invitations to the exclusive Most Innovative Companies Honoree Summit and Honoree Dinner in New York. Additionally, all applicants will receive an exclusive Most Innovative Companies Innovation Trends Report curated by Fast Company editors. Now, I love this opportunity because it offers a way for small businesses to break out and get noticed. Notice not only by potential customers, but also by potential strategic partners, investors, and the press. And it's big breaks like these that can be simply transformative. There is a cost to apply. To learn more and to get your application in, go to fastcompany.com. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
It's one of our favorite days, of course. It's Thursday, so it's Therapy Thursday. Dr. Steve Craig, psychologist and corporate coach for Craig Counseling Services in Bloomfield Hills, is here, but you brought guests. It's a family affair.
Family affair and gifts. I brought them all copies of my book, and I brought my mother and my wife, both of who are really responsible for everything.
Oh, that's sweet.
The dedication to Rana is beautiful.
And anytime a Nana could be here, I'm happy about it. That's so hi. All right, what do you have for us?
Okay, today, Dr. Steve, my wife and I recently took our 11-year-old daughter to therapy because she was talking to her school counselor about killing herself. She's gone about 10 times now, and I sat in on one of the sessions last week and was horrified to find that her therapist was incompetent and enabling. When my daughter talked about hurting herself, instead of providing her with any tools or doing anything to stop her, like telling her not to do it, explaining her how horrible it would make everyone feel, how wrong it was, or even calling the police, instead she asked her how she wanted to do it, why she wanted to do it, when she wanted to do it, and what she thought it would accomplish. Oh my God. My daughter regaled her with an incredibly scary description, but that thankfully involved lethal methods she could never acquire as an 11-year-old. But it was incredibly scary to sit there and listen to her therapist actually help my daughter further contemplate how and why she would take her own life. How does this woman keep her license? But there's nothing I can do about it because apparently my daughter loves this therapist, which of course she does because she's not holding her accountable. And my wife tells the therapist and everyone else that the problems are with me being too controlling and abusive to our daughter. So I have no choice but to, because if I pull her out of therapy to get a, I have no choice but to get her a new therapist. But when I do it, I will just be playing more into the narrative, which only makes my daughter more depressed. But I also can't let her keep seeing this woman. How do I find a good therapist and switch her ASAP without being pegged as controlling? Who's up?
This is scary because of the social media world, and 11-year-olds probably do think like this sometimes. So I'm just saying I'm scared, but I'm not ready for my answer yet.
I mean, you had me until it got to the dad saying that, well, they're blaming me, therefore I'm blaming the therapist. There seems to be some transference going on here, and someone, not everybody, should be taking some accountability for what's happening to this child. It's the premise of an 11-year-old contemplating suicide is horrifying.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Mm-hmm. But if dad needs to be a little bit more open-minded, that maybe he is controlling, there is something that's driving this child in that direction.
And I'm not a therapist, so, you know, I don't know how therapists talk to people. This is, it appears, maybe one time, one of their sessions that he sat in on and this happened. And I don't know if the therapist was trying to, you know, get her to confide in them more and to feel comfortable with them more and then start talking to her about some other things, but just kind of letting her speak. I don't know. That's what it appears to me, that maybe that she was just trying to get her confidence and then, you know, maybe come with something better later. But this was only one session and you just kind of walked in on that one time.
I'm really interested to hear your critique.
Jamie,
of the
you're
counselor.
Out, you're out.
I think it's my child. I'm not comfortable with this therapy. Maybe we get a new therapist. I looked at him like, I don't know if I'm right.
So this is going to surprise a lot of people, but hooray for this therapist.
Okay.
Hooray for this therapist. When people are depressed or suicidal, they feel broken, damaged, criticized, misunderstood, powerless. That's the core thing that's going on. The last thing we should do is do more of that. That's what got them here in the first place.
Tell them that they're wrong.
You tell them, you know, so people always hire, like, they can be critical, they can be judgmental, it's not working with their kids, so they hire their therapist so that we could do more of the same. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't, or just harsher maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about feeling of hurting yourself, all the things, doesn't encourage you to do it more. It actually gives the person the feeling of empowerment over their own feeling, their own what. She's trying to empower her. Tell me how you feel. What's important to you? And when that person feels like that they actually have some, we would call it, you know, locus of control in their life, some, I can make decisions and I do have power, then they stop feeling suicidal and hopeless. Now, it feels like a dangerous game because it feels like
it's contrarian,
you're,
right,
yes,
to a degree.
It feels like you're, well, go ahead, talk about
yeah.
it. But they're already thinking about it. You're not encouraging them to do more, but man, you're able to get them to talk about it and say, well, why is that important? And the process of doing that makes people feel much better.
Shouldn't that be, though, expressed to the parents before you get into the therapy session so that their expectations are not shock when they hear something that is not what they would assume would be the right thing to say?
Great question. And in a perfect world, you'd have the time and opportunity to say, let me understand, let me explain the process. Here's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. But
and
that
why?
Always, yes, and why. And, but that doesn't always work because sometimes the parent, because if your daughter's talking about this, the parents are freaking out about it.
Right.
They're like, that's what you're going to do? New therapist.
Yeah.
Like, no, you're supposed to tell her not to do it. So you have to be careful. You have to start. And at some point during the therapy, you pull the parent in and you say, listen, I want you to understand why we're doing what we're doing. But we don't know this guy, and this happens too. Parents just show up. Hey, I'm here. Can I sit in?
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden, all this goes on.
Right.
And they don't understand what happens. I mean, another.
But if they could have, if those parents had the benefit of what you just said in 60 seconds, right. It doesn't have to take the full session. Just say, before we get to your right. daughter, I need 5 minutes of your time.
Right. And so. Maybe the therapist has done that with the mom. Maybe she was about to. We don't know that stuff. These are the quick little scenario right. that mm-hmm. somebody wrote. But yes, ideally the therapist is going to explain the plan ahead of time. And ideally the parents have invested ahead of time in, what are we doing here? Tell me what the plan is. Right. Let's talk about it, rather than right. just.
Because this would be shocking to a parent to hear.
Yeah. It would be shocking. And parents don't, so you have to have some faith in the therapist knows what they're doing. And when I explained it that way, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But we have to put the kid in the real experience, meaning I'm putting you in a relationship where you feel empowered, where you feel hopeful. Then I can do some work with you rather than just becoming that same parent.
And it seems like the system worked. If she was talking to her school counselor, the counselor yes. got the therapy.
She's been coming 10 times.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So she's getting better. Or theoretically.
We've only got a few seconds. Yeah. But if you're confronted by a school counselor with this kind of news as a parent, should you address it with your child or should you wait for them to get before a therapist?
If a school counselor says this is what your daughter
yeah,
said?
I mean, because your instant reaction as a parent, I got to do something, right? Should you wait before they get into a session?
I'm missing the question. Wait to talk to the kid.
What should I do as a parent? Mom and dad, they get this news. What the hell do I do?
You talk to the counselor and you immediately get a therapist.
Okay.
That's what you do.
Okay. Right. And don't try to fix it on your own.
Get some professional help.
That's what I
get. There we go. Dr. Steve Craig, psychologist and corporate coach for Craig Counseling Services in Bloomfield Hills. Thank you.
We'll fix our communication problem next week.
Yeah. Yeah.
That went awry. You two need therapy.
We need help, you guys.
Yeah.
Yes.
Coming up next, the Supreme Court making a decision when it comes to abortions in Idaho at 7:35.
My goodness, what a Chamber of Commerce day it is for the Rocket Mortgage Classic. Round one already underway out at Detroit Golf Club, and we already have a highlight.
Yeah, according to Tony Paul of the news, there's been an ace already. 2019 champion Nate Lashley jarred it at the long par 3 11th.
All right. So it's getting exciting already. Too bad it wasn't on the 313 hole.
They right. have yet to get 313.
I know. We need to change our area
they have
code
the insurance.
To 323.
Yeah.
We had several decisions come down over the past several days from the Supreme Court. We also had an interesting decision come down from the Court of Claims here in the state of Michigan, basically throwing out the 24-hour waiting period for an abortion that has been on the books for a long, long time. The judge in the case saying that it conflicted with what the voters approved at the ballot in the midterm elections in 2022 when they voted by a significant margin to protect reproductive rights in the Constitution for the state of Michigan. But at the time, we were told that there were going to be some limits on the right to an abortion. Well, it appears that one of those rights just got nailed in the Court of Claims. To talk about it, David Coleman, attorney for Coleman Legal Group and senior legal counsel with the Great Lakes Justice Center. David, good morning.
Good morning.
There we got you. I know you're not the kind of guy to say, I told you so, but I bet you're thinking it.
Bad connection here.
You know what? I'm going to let you redial.
Yeah.
Just real quickly, because I'm so eager to hear what you have to say about this. Because when we were going through this, and I had David on my afternoon show at the time that we were debating this, and the way it was written in the proposal left a lot open to subjective interpretation about, you know, it relied on the legislature to come up with enabling legislation to kind of put some guardrails in here.
And people knew that. at that time.
Right. And yeah. There was the presumption amongst the supporters that were out there selling this from the reproductive rights side of things, saying, oh, no, it will be just reinstituting what there was with Roe, that it'll be about a 24-week liability test, mm-hmm. That parental consent will still be okay. They're not going to be going after that. The 24-hour waiting period will probably be okay. Well, now it seems that they're nibbling at the margins. Right. And the folks in the pro-life community are saying, you know, we tried to warn you about this. David, are you back with us? Not yet. Okay. Well, I mean, this is what folks feared was going to happen. And when we challenged folks in the reproductive rights community about it, you know, there was an unstated pledge that these protections would be intact.
All right, devil's advocate. If you're trying to get an abortion, you believe in abortion, why should you have to wait 24 hours?
Good question.
Why should there be this this sort of impediment for someone who they believe is getting a medical procedure?
Because it's an irreversible procedure, and maybe a day of reflection is not a bad thing.
I agree with that, but I'm trying to make the argument.
He's got an answer to your question. David, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me now?
Yes, loud and clear.
Bless you and the landline you called in on.
There are no landlines.
The little bit I heard, you're exactly right. We were told when this constitutional amendment was passed 2 years ago that we were fear-mongering, that we're bringing up things that weren't true, that laws would be nullified that are on the books. But that's exactly what happened yesterday.
I was just being a devil's advocate and saying, okay, if this is passed in our state and people believe this is a medical procedure, why should they have to wait the 24 hours?
Well, there's lots of procedures and things where you have waiting periods and things that have to be done. I don't think a 24-hour waiting period is any impediment that's going to stop anyone from carrying out any medical procedure that they want to do.
Now, the Supreme Court's recent actions suggest that's a procedural delay rather than a final decision on Idaho's abortion law. So how significant do you think this delay is, and what is the implications for a future challenge in this area?
Yeah, I think the Idaho decision was, it's really a technical decision that the court made. They did not rule on whether or not the merits of the case were accurate or not. Mm-hmm. They just simply ruled it was premature.
David, you know, you're saying that someone doesn't have standing or punting on it. Can't mm-hmm. that be done? I mean, we've been waiting.
They still took the case.
Yeah. Right. Why take the case right. if you're not going to decide it? Or can't you determine lack of standing when you're deciding whether to take the case? It just seems like we should be avoiding these non-decisions, that we need more from our Supreme Court.
You would sure think so. You know, it was a 6-3 decision yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Idaho law is a law that just bans abortions for any reason, except for the life of the mother, or in the first trimester if it's a rape or incest situation. And it makes it a felony for a doctor to provide such an abortion. And so that's the law that was stayed by the federal courts. Supreme Court took it up and then changed its mind and said, no, now we're not going to rule at this point. And you're right. I think they should just take the case and decide it, but they didn't. They sent it back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on a technicality.
And we should point out this was a leaked decision. So, I mean, right. It could have been a draft.
What is happening with these leaks?
I'm telling you.
Especially on this issue.
On abortion, yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, we had the same thing happen with the Dobbs decision 2 years ago. And isn't it interesting that it's only on abortion cases that this seems to happen?
Are you surprised by the way the majority is on this court, some of the decisions when it comes to mifepristone, when it comes to this Idaho case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has been interesting. It seems like you have Kavanaugh and Thomas and Barrett are in one group. And then you have, of course, the three liberals that are on the bench. And then you have Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch. So it's almost like you have three different camps.
Yeah, I think you meant to say Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Barrett.
Yeah, Roberts, I'm sorry. Yeah. Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. And you have Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch. Yes.
Well, it kind of puts a bit of a hole in the progressive argument that this is nothing but a Supreme Court of conservative ideologues trying to force feed their opinions down the throats of the American people, doesn't it? Because we've seen them rule on the law, not on a political agenda, time and time again this past session, or at least it seems that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've seen other decisions that have been 9-0 and 8-1. So, you know, this claim by the left that this is a court that's just going to do what Donald Trump wants, or that they're just conservatives and will vote in lockstep, is simply not true.
The immunity case when it comes to Donald Trump could be decided fairly soon, and then we'll see if they do what he wants them to do.
And if it happens today, what is that going to mean for the debate tonight?
Yes, that could be very interesting if they release that decision today. And I'll tell you another big decision that's going to come down is this case on the Chevron doctrine for agencies.
Right.
And whether or not the courts have to give deference to the agencies, or whether or not people can get a fair shake and get protections in the courts from overbearing agencies.
Yeah, the idea of the administration state and overreach. I've got to ask you, tonight in the debate, David, I know you're going to be listening with a very practiced ear. Donald Trump has tried to stake out some middle ground here on abortion. How do you think that will be consumed by the pro-life community? Do you think you're going to be encouraged and disappointed? He said, look, before I can do anything, I got to get elected, so I've got to compromise on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, there's a lot of nuanced positions in the pro-life camp as well as on the progressive side of things. Donald Trump, I think, has laid out his position, and of course it's not going to satisfy everyone on the pro-life side, and myself included. But I will say this, he did put three justices on the Supreme Court, and we got the Dobbs decision, so I think that says a lot.
All right, David Kallman, we will await to see how this claims court decision on the 24-hour waiting period is going to be addressed in the Court of Appeals, because it will be appealed, and hopefully someday we'll get a decision of maybe greater scope from the Supremes instead of just a punt. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
All right. David Kallman, attorney for Kallman Legal Group and senior legal counsel for Great Lakes Justice. We want to send you to see the Eagles at the Sphere in Las Vegas. This is an amazing venue. I mean, just looking at it is amazing. And when you get to see the Eagles and all the multimedia stuff they can do, looking back at their legendary career going back 50 years, it's going to be something special. They're performing 16 shows September 20th through December 14th. But to be eligible to win this amazing prize package that we have, you need to know the national keyword for the hour. And that keyword is limit. Text LIMIT to 95819, and you can be eligible for flights, stay at the Venetian, two tickets for two to see the Eagles in the Sphere. And to enter for your chance to win, just send LIMIT to 95819. Back in a moment.
You know, every year, Detroiters eagerly anticipate the fireworks displays, but underlying this excitement are deeper issues that deserve some attention, one of which is the riverfront parks in Detroit, which were closed and guarded by police on the night of the fireworks. There's an opinion piece in the Detroit Free Press, and we have on the JR live line is Nancy Caffer. She's editorial page editor for the Detroit Free Press. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you know, the closure of the riverfronts during the fireworks has gone on for a while, but talk about what are your thoughts on the reasons though behind the closures? You know, talking about safety and you know, and public access and safety. It's a balance there somewhere, but we're not getting it.
Yeah. So the Detroit police, you know, had talked to us about, you know, as we know, unfortunately, there have been violent incidents at the fireworks in the past. People have been hurt. And because of that, and because of, you know, it's such a spectacular event and wanting to make sure people are safe and protected there, they had made the decision to restrict access to a few locations that they felt they had the resources to adequately police. And that means that, you know, closing these neighborhood parks, which now technically, you know, they close at 10 p.m. on a normal day. So they're not, quote unquote, closing them. They're not just keeping them open or allowing residents to go there for the fireworks, which, I mean, I live in Southwest, close to West Riverfront Park, which really stinks. It would be an amazing place to watch mm-hmm. the fireworks, but that's the challenge, is the public safety and the resources to police.
I believe the headline was Detroiters deserve more. Do you think mm-hmm. they should figure out a way to do it differently?
Yeah, you know, we do. No one wants people to get hurt, right? Like, we want to be safe at events in our city. We want people to be able to come from all over our city and feel safe. We want people to come from outside the city and feel safe and be safe. But yeah, it really, like I said, I'm here in Southwest Detroit. My colleague, Khalil Hodgel, who wrote the column, is here in Southwest Detroit. You know, we both be friends over on the East Side. It'd be really great to walk to those parks, especially, I don't know, if you're a parent with a young kid, you don't necessarily want to take them down to Hart Plaza where you got to get there early. It's a huge crush of people. It's not something that you might, it's a lot. I'm not big on crowds, like super intense crowds. So, and the other thing, I mean, we have these wonderful, award-winning, amazingly transformed riverfront. It would be great to be able to utilize that.
Well, of course it would be great, but we also don't want to set up a scenario where our DPD guys are spread too thinly. So what's the solution?
I don't know what the solution is, but I think it's a conversation that has to start, right? Like, it has to start with the premise of how can we do this? Because it's clearly something that's touched a nerve in the community. There are folks, we had this piece in the works, and then, lots and lots and lots of people read it and shared it. And there had been stuff going around on the day of the fireworks. It's, there has to be at some point, some level of trust between the city and its residents. There has to be, some kind of cooperation, maybe, I'm not sure that there's been a history in neighborhood firework watching locations of problems. So, what is an assessment of what a risk level might be? Because right now, so again, I live just south of Mexican Town, and on fireworks night, my family walked up to a spot over by the interstate where we could get a good view of downtown. And there's, folks in vacant lots and parking lots, camped out in chairs. So you've got folks congregating. There are a couple of police cars around, but largely unpoliced. So there's a little, there are folks congregating in spots where you can see the fireworks. So, it's not like people have said, oh, the parks are closed, we're staying inside. So what is the trade-off there between, you do have folks out in groups to watch the fireworks, they just can't do it at the park. It's a little challenging, but no, nobody wants anybody to get hurt.
Well, it's not just getting someone getting hurt, though. That should be our primary concern. The secondary concern is we remember Cassandra and Cassandra Rutherford in a beatdown that got on video. It went viral before we knew what viral was. You remember the damage to the city's reputation that did. So it can be, the hurt can be compounded.
Yeah, it absolutely, and that 100%, we don't want the city to look, bad in public. That hurt is the first priority, but then of course, I care about our city's reputation. But also you can't say, I don't know, I have a 13-year-old son, and sometimes he does things and we have to say, hey bud, that's not right. And we have to, you're not allowed to do such and such for a while, but you can't do that forever, right? First of all, we're not a city of children, but second of all, you can't restrict forever, right? There has to be a point where you can say, okay, let's have that back. Let's add that on. And the city, so many amazing things are happening in the city.
Right.
NFL draft was great. There's so many people downtown. I know the NFL.
Perfect example.
And the draft itself was a pretty tightly controlled event, but all around that, bars, restaurants, alternate viewing sites, all that stuff. How many 100,000 people were down there?
Yeah,
700.
Well, and Nancy, my thing is this as well. When you talk about the NFL draft, I mean, it wasn't just DPD; it was state police, it was the sheriff, all of those people combined. Now, the fireworks is a huge event where people come from all around to take part in it, and I don't see why you couldn't, if it's about manpower, that you couldn't bring even more people in. Now, somebody has to pay for it, but, I think it could be a fund for that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, think about this too. Angels Night, right? Like, Devil's Night used to be a night when there were a lot of fires in Detroit. The community stepped in.
Right.
Community patrols, community groups saying, we don't want this anymore. The city, backing it is a partnership. And now there are, I think the last time I read this, I think there's, I'm maybe over my skis here, but I think there are fewer fires on Angels Night than there are any other night of the year. Like, there's a certain number of fires in any
exactly.
big city on any given night. But so that's a thing where, so maybe there's, because I really, and well, maybe I'm getting this wrong, but I feel like that in these neighborhood parks, you're going to see more families. You're going to see more mm-hmm. folks from the area rather
with
than
prime viewing spots.
Yes.
With prime for free. Viewing spots. Yeah. With, you know, well, not with our taxes and with the other stuff that we, but we put, you know, if there's some kind of, I don't know, what about some kind of neighborhood partnership like we've had on Angels Night that's had such amazing success? Because it's a community full of people that really care right. about this kind of thing. Detroiters don't want Detroit to be, you know, perceived as dangerous or foolish or like the, you know, the video you were talking about.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Nancy Caffer, editorial page editor for the Detroit Free Press. We appreciate you being here this morning. Great piece in the Free Press.
Well, really appreciate you having me. Thank you so much.
Take care.
And coming up, the top news stories of the day, plus the first suspect charged in the shooting death of Bradley Reck.
Kind of appropriate we're playing freeze frame because when they cut the mics tonight, that's what we may see. you're going to have the one candidate talking and you're going to hear him, and the other one is just going to be in the two box standing there doing what? Shaking their head?
Shaking their head.
Waving their hand like, oh, this guy's...
I think they're still going to be trying to make their points.
Mimicking.
Yeah. Miming?
Know, miming and doing their, yeah. you know, their mouth.
It's going to be a different kind of experience with the mic cuts. And CNN demonstrated it. It is kind of awkward, especially if the other person tries to say something.
You might hear him off mic.
You
right?
can hear off mic. I wonder if it all goes to blazes. Well, we'll see Trump or Biden walk over to the other guy whose mic is hot and start debating that way.
It's only 8 feet between them.
Well, that's just two really well-timed strides.
I mean, we've been exactly. talking about this for so long. I'm happy it's happening. You know, I'm sick of talking about
it. It's not happened yet. I mean, honestly, it wouldn't surprise me in the least if somebody didn't pull the plug.
Really?
Yeah. That would be such bad press, though.
You've already got Donald Trump plowing fertile earth here, saying the whole thing's rigged. It's 3-on-1. I mean, when you're arguing about the refs that far in advance of the game, it either says you don't have game or you're trying to prepare for something. Biden, I don't know. If he wakes up this morning and doesn't think he can stand for 90 minutes, do you risk everything on that?
I just think
that makes
neither,
it worse, though.
I think neither will pull out because of the bad press and how Donald Trump has said, you know, I'll debate anytime, anywhere. You got to go through with it now.
Well, it's interesting. All of his surrogates are out there saying, you know, how unfair this is, as if somehow he didn't make the deal. His people negotiated this.
The
mic cuts, no audience, no notes was key for them, and they got that. And I think that's huge for Joe Biden. When do you ever see Joe Biden speaking without notes?
Yeah.
This is going to be a stretch for him.
If someone pulls out, it hurts Biden more than it hurts Trump, because if Trump were to pull out, he'd just pull out and his people would say, okay, no big deal. But if Biden pulls out, they're going to say, oh, he pulled out because he can't stand for 90 minutes or something. He's too old or something.
What are the issues that you don't think have received nearly enough attention or nearly enough meat on the bone? I mean, from both of them, I want to hear them address the idea that in 2033, we're going to see an automatic 21% cut to Social Security benefits unless you somehow figure out a way to make Social Security solvent by that date. So what's your plan? Or are you going to stand by and watch those benefits automatically be cut by a fifth?
I want to hear everybody. What they're going to do about gun violence. We have a real problem here. What are we going to do about it?
And find that line between allowing people to protect their homes, but also having some common sense things.
Mm-hmm.
We've taken some steps here in Michigan. Should that be done federally?
And I think mental health as well. Mental health is a crisis across the country, and something needs to be done. We have these places that have been closed. There's no place for people to go.
Logistically, what are you going to do?
What are you
going to
do?
Well, and we know that the southern border is going to be getting a lot of attention. This young girl in Texas lost her life to two illegal immigrants. Donald Trump is going to make her the poster child of the evening, and as well as he should, if making this point. But we should acknowledge there's 10.5 million illegal immigrants in this country, according to the Migration Policy Institute. I think there's actually more than that, but let's say it's 10.5 million. That's the population of Michigan.
Yeah.
So Donald Trump says he's going to start mass deportations. Well, 82% of those 10.5 million people have been here longer than 10 years. Many of them have jobs. Employers rely on them to show up to work. Many are paying taxes.
They have families.
Some of them are a burden, no question about it. Some of them are criminals, no question
That's
about
right.
it.
That's right.
Well, but in if your you do the math, yeah. They've been here while he was president, too.
Exactly. And he didn't deport them then. So what will your priorities be? Who are you going to deport first? Who won't you be deporting? I hope he answers that question. And about the tipped economy, why is the income I make somehow going to be taxed on a full boat, but someone else that is in the hospitality industry gets to keep all their tips tax-free? Mm-hmm. Is that what you call a fair tax structure, a fair tax code?
Well, let's see if they deliver on all of those things tonight.
Yeah. Or if we can, you're right.
With the mic cuts, maybe we'll actually be able to hear something. It won't be a replay of the first debate.
It definitely won't be that.
In 2020. And, you know, how harshly do you judge Joe Biden? 90 minutes is a long time to be on your feet for a guy that
for anyone.
Is having obvious difficulty walking in a certain awkward gait. Also, again, the no notes thing, I think. And for Donald Trump, you know, you've got to fact check Joe Biden, and Joe Biden has to fact check Donald Trump in real time because the moderators aren't supposed to be doing it tonight. Can Donald Trump do that? Can he stay focused on point? Does he have the ammo to come back and say, here's why that's a lie? Bang, bang, bang. You said you created that many jobs? Most of those were pre-pandemic jobs that just came back. You can't take credit for that. Will he be able to do that? I can't tell you the number of times I've watched him debate, and I've screamed at the TV, you just left points off the board that you could have made.
He just lobbed one over the plate, and you just let it go. Yeah. Well, 18-year-old Clinton Township resident Kareem Blake Moore, he's been charged in connection with the murder of Oakland County Sheriff's Deputy Bradley Reckling. Moore was arraigned yesterday. He was arraigned on 3 counts of lying to a peace officer and 1 count of resisting arrest. Deputy Reckling, a 9-year veteran, fatally shot on Saturday night while investigating a stolen vehicle. He was behind the stolen Chevrolet Equinox on Detroit's east side, and the suspects stopped. They got out of the car, and they started shooting. It hit Reckling in the head and chest. Using a dog track, police located the suspects nearby and found 2 guns and a glove along the path. And during interrogation, Moore admitted to being in the stolen vehicle, but he denied firing the shots. He says, listen, I fear for my safety if I go to prison and get out. I'm not saying anything. Oakland County Sheriff Mike Bouchard called the incident an ambush. Wayne County Assistant Prosecutor Matthew Penny told the judge why he wanted a high bond for Moore.
This is a man with a flight risk. He is in the thick of something that is very deep and very, very serious. He chose to, by his own account, after seeing police lights, ran from the vehicle, ran with 2 others who were apparently involved, ran 3 blocks away from the scene where the officer unfortunately expired. And it resulted in a dog track finding them within a relatively short period of time on a porch that they didn't belong on.
Moore's bond set at $100,000 cash, no 10%, a hearing scheduled for Friday. Those other 2 still being held on gun charges from a previous incident that they had in Troy.
Adam Silver, 5th pick. This is what the Pistons did.
With the 5th pick in the 2024 NBA Draft, the Detroit Pistons select Ron Holland II from Dallas, Texas, and the NBA G League's team, Ignite.
So he's 6'7", forward. He's from the G League. You know, he has this tremendous upside. He's athletic. He may need some shooting help. The Pistons have hired new shooting coaches, so there's that. But when I texted my husband, who's the biggest NBA person I know, he goes, wow, great upside there. So if it's realized.
A diamond in the rough that they can make into a star, hopefully. Right. By the way, Detroit is home to the most overpriced homes, overvalued homes in America, which means that's good for us if you're selling your home now. But it also means that the bubble could burst. And by the way, Spotify, cutting prices by $1 a month, that's not a lot. They're just not telling you about it. So there's a new plan called Basic. Check it out. It'll save you money. $12 a year. I'll take that.
I'll take the 12.
Hey.
The legislature is saving money on K-12 education. They did not appropriate as much money for K-12 as they did last year. What's behind that? We'll find out from a superintendent. It says this is not the way to fund schools. Next on JR Morning. While you were sleeping, the Michigan legislature appropriated $83 billion of your tax dollars. The budget takes effect October 1st of this year. It's the 2025 budget. Last year, they appropriated $21.5 billion for K-12 education. This year, they've appropriated $900 million
less than that. But they are opening the door for local districts to save money by allocating $500 million, or a little more than that, to lower the amount of money that they need to pay into their employee retirement funds. Some Republicans are saying you're kind of building a house of cards here, because if the economy turns south, you can be on the hook for a lot of liabilities that will then allow a bigger bite. Watching all of this with more than just interest is the Michigan Association of Superintendents Administrators that blasted this approach to funding. Joining us live this morning, Andrew Brody, region president of that group and also superintendent of Flat Rock Community Schools. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning, everyone. How are you?
Good. Very good. Is this basically, do you view this as a gimmick, a one-time fix?
Guy, this is a terrible budget for Michigan public schools. It really puts us in a place where we don't really know what to do beyond this school year, because none of the monies that were provided to schools this year have any type of legacy to them whatsoever. So there was no per pupil funding increase this year, meaning there's nothing that's going to sustain over time. So really hard to figure out what to do right now. Most school districts in the state have already passed their budget prior to this budget being passed this morning. We had to make some assumptions. Those assumptions are made off of information that we get back in March and in February when they present their budgets, the House, the Senate, the governor. So we make some assumptions. And right now, I would assume a lot of my colleagues, a lot of school boards, a lot of people are scrambling to try to figure out what they're going to do to amend their budgets. It's really, really disappointing.
And this is at a time when a lot of them were losing some COVID funding, like we saw in Ann Arbor anyway, and having to, they're already scrambling in
some
districts.
It's the COVID cliff.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing. Over the last 10 years, we have historically gotten an increase in per pupil funding each year, with the exception of 2021. But in that year, that's the year that all the COVID funding came in. So that was a very good supplement for us. I think one of the biggest issues in this budget that I can see, beyond the MIPSRS thing and the retirement thing, and I think we'll figure all that out, work that out down the road, is, you know, last year they allocated millions upon millions of dollars for school safety, mental health supports. They've basically allocated just $17 a student for that this year. So you're talking school districts, SROs, you're talking counselors, social workers, behavior interventionists, psychologists. People are going to have to make a lot of difficult decisions over the next 6 to 12 months as to how they move forward.
So, Andrew, you see that, you know, without this long-term funding relief, there's just going to be layoffs?
I you know what, if a school district does not have a robust enough fund balance to weather that storm, yeah, you're going to see layoffs, which is really, really disappointing, because we were really on a good trajectory, really focusing on the whole child and how we support each and every kid at the level that they're at. And yeah, I think in some districts that haven't been as fortunate to save some money based on different things that happened to them over time, I think you'll see some difficult decisions that have to be made sooner rather than later.
Andrew, Representative Matt Colazar says that the school districts reduce what they have to pay into the retirement system, so that makes available $300 to $500 per student. How is there this disconnect by what you're saying and what he's saying, which is, quote, this is a historic investment in our schools?
Well, it's a historic investment from the perspective that that's basically public school money staying with public schools. But there should have been a support bill along with that. Senate Bill 911 should have accompanied that to give it some longevity, some legacy, and it doesn't. It's a one and done. So really hard for school districts to figure out what to do with that extra $300 or $400 a kid if I can't take it next year as well and ensure that I can get raises, do program advancements, and things of that nature. Really, really difficult place for us to be right now.
But also curious, I mean, Andrew, you watched this, the unions backed it, and it's their pension fund. Also, yep. Elements of the business community supported this as well.
Because it makes sense. This fund is fully funded at 140%. Taking 7% out of it was not going to negatively impact it. It was still going to be paid off in time in 2038. It just made a lot of sense. For Flat Rock alone, it would have been about $780,000. And that's a huge amount of money for a school district our size.
You know, you talked about mental health, too, which is big, you know, across the country, and especially in our schools. And what about the funding for mental health? You have a lot of school districts. I know here in Detroit, they have these health hubs that are helping with mental health, but there are a lot of districts that don't have that and need something like that.
Yeah, and we were, again, we were on a really good trajectory. You know, 10 years ago, Flat Rock only had two social workers. We now have one in every building. We have counselors in our high school and middle school now that we didn't have before. We have behavior interventionists in our elementary schools to help with different behaviors and social and emotional learning. And I really fear what happens next in a lot of places that don't have a fund balance to support that as we try to figure out the next step.
What about this idea that the money coming in, this $300 to $500 per student, you have more freedom to spend it than if it were through the other traditional way?
Yeah, again, I agree. We do have more autonomy to spend those dollars. My fear is where you spend them, will it have a legacy cost that I can't support the following school year, mm-hmm. right? Do I hire people just to lay them off a year from now? Mm-hmm. Right. That sets everybody up for failure. If you bring in human resources to support students and then they're not there the next year, that can be very traumatic to a kid.
If just the intersection with a child that's, you know, heaven forbid, a future Ethan Crumbly, isn't this the early warning system? Aren't these the canaries that are supposed to catch the gas in the mine?
And that's on all of us, right? So when you put $300 million into school safety one year and then put $26 million into it the following year, I'm really not sure what a lot of us are supposed to do when it comes to those early warning signs, making sure that we have the protections and the peace of mind for people to send their kids to school every single day. These are my concerns right now. These are the things I'm thinking through on June 27th. As this budget gets passed this morning at 5 a.m.
Well, we will be watching, and everybody should be watching your local school board as they struggle with these choices that have now been thrust upon them by the budget making in Lansing. Andrew Brody, we so appreciate your perspective on all of this.
No, I appreciate your time, and just so everyone out there knows, we will be ready come fall for everyone's kids to come back. That's what we do, and we'll make the best of it.
There you go, and we appreciate that, too. Take care, Andrew.
Thank you, sir.
He was convicted in an arson case that led to the deaths of two people. But 11 years after that conviction, it's been ruled an invalid conviction, and now he's free. You'll meet him next on JR Morning at 8:35. And it's a morning and a whole new day, a whole new life for the gentleman that you're about to meet. I remember this story so well. It was August of 2012. Mm-hmm. Two people die in a house fire. I'm sure you covered
yep.
it, too.
Mm-hmm.
It was an arson fire. The alleged arsonist was a member of the family at the time, Dwayne Williams, and he was convicted of felony murder, convicted to a life sentence. He served 11 years of that, and then just earlier this month, that conviction was vacated because of a number of flaws that certainly at the time should have raised red flags. But on June 18th, Dwayne Williams, after 11 years of incarceration, was freed, and he is in our studio now, along with Maya Menlo, who is the assistant defender for the State Appellate Defender Office that handled this case that allowed for his freedom. Dwayne, good morning.
How you doing? Good morning, guy.
It's great to have you here.
Yes, it is.
I just got to tell you, there was just a moment when you stepped in here and you looked over at mine and you said, help me silence this phone. Help me turn this off. Few things have changed since you were out here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I was
telling, so that was like one of those little things that I'm sure you're having to deal with now.
Yeah, I was telling her, it was the second morning I was out, and I was in my room, and the night before, my brother knocked on the door, and he, like, talked to the radio to turn it down. So
Alexa.
So right. So as the night went on, the radio was on, but I was worried that it was disturbing either my brother or my nephew. So I kept saying, Siri, volume 8. So when I finally at some point fell asleep. And in the morning, my brother knocked on the door and he asked me, he said, how you doing? Everything all right? I said, yeah, but Siri won't listen to me. He said, that's because it's Alexa.
So just the little things about how life changed while you were gone for more than a decade. So tell me about that moment when you got the news.
Well, first of all, we didn't really think that I would be released on the 18th. We knew that the convictions would be vacated, but we didn't think that I would be released that day. So when I was in court, first of all, when the judge vacated my sentence, I was like, I like teared up because I knew it was over. I couldn't believe it was over. Mm-hmm. And then, they moved on to bond.
Excuse me.
When they moved on to bond, Ms. Menlo was explaining the reentry plans. I had two reentry plans, and Judge Cobb kind of cut her off, and he said he wanted to know about a particular person. And when he said that, I thought in my head, wow, he thinking about giving me bond, which we didn't think was going to happen. And it was unbelievable when he did what he did. It was unbelievable. So,
Maya, talk about some of the evidence that led to him, you know, coming out and having that be vacated.
Sure. So this case came to the State Appellate Defender Office in 2021, and pretty quickly we realized that this was the type of case that could go to the Conviction Integrity Unit in Wayne County. And little background here, the premise of the state's theory was that this was an intentionally set fire, that it was an arson. Okay. Mm-hmm. The defense theory was that this was a careless smoking incident where perhaps a lit cigarette had been dropped into a couch and that resulted in the fire. And nobody disputed that the area of origin of the fire was the couch. So that was plausible. But the fire investigator from the Detroit Fire Department came and testified that there was no evidence whatsoever of smoking, that no smoking materials had been found. In our investigation, through FOIAs and other means, we obtained photos of a lighter that was in the area of origin near the couch. And we also obtained a version that had not yet been disclosed to the defense of a fire report that included information about that lighter being there. After that, once the Conviction Integrity Unit got involved, there were more disclosures and more revelations, including witness statements that had not been disclosed previously that contradicted some of the state's evidence. And given all that, the Conviction Integrity Unit agreed that these convictions were wrongful and that they could not stand behind them. And so they stipulated or agreed to vacate the convictions.
Dwayne, you have stated all along that you did not do this. You were innocent. It took someone believing you and working for you. You were emotional sitting here next to me. Thank goodness that someone believed you and did the work.
Yeah. I think the worst part is, like, I was telling Ms. Menlo yesterday in our office that I would come out into the day room and, like, we can move around at 6 o'clock. So at 6 o'clock in the morning, I take all my transcripts and all my legal stuff, and I start trying to figure things out, trying to, like, figure out how I can show what happened to me. And a lot of times, it'll be 10 o'clock at night when the light's out, and I've been at the table all day. And I wrote, like, I don't know, I got, if you can see, like, that and that. That's from writing
letters.
You
have blisters on your hands.
Yeah, from writing letters. And so to finally, like, it was a blessing to get somebody like Ms. Menlo, because most lawyers, they don't listen to you. And she listened to me. And it's like when you're going through the appeal process, you meet with your lawyer one time and that's it. And they don't accept your phone calls. I had countless meetings with Ms. Menlo and countless phone calls. And that's like unusual. That doesn't happen. And that's why, unfortunately, I guarantee you that it's so many cases that need to be overturned, but they don't have the help that I had. Mm-hmm. And so it's sad, not particularly speaking just about Detroit and Wayne County and however that system might work, but the overall system is sad that it doesn't work, because you have all these entities and departments in place. So you would think that the system would work, but these entities kind of don't pay attention to you. So
you're grateful for
yeah, beyond words.
This was a deeply flawed conviction, and the judge agreed with that, vacated it. That's not an exoneration. So where are we with that, and is there something more that you need, Dwayne? And Maya, I want you to weigh in on the same question as well.
Yes. Yeah, so where we are right now is that the prosecutor is reviewing the case for the viability of, for example, taking it to trial again. The Conviction Integrity Unit is separate from the rest of the prosecutor's office. Mm-hmm. And so this case is now in the homicide division once again, being reviewed with fresh eyes by a different prosecutor than the one who handled the case initially. So that review period should be about 60 to 90 days. And at the end of that time, hopefully we'll know whether they're dismissing the case or moving forward. And of course, we'd hope that given everything that happened, they'll dismiss the case entirely.
You know, unreliable testimony was part of this as well. And we see this all the time. I mean, how common is that in these wrongful convictions?
The jailhouse snitch.
Yeah.
We see a lot of cases involving jailhouse informants. So I can't put a number on it, but there's a large proportion of wrongful convictions that are based at least in part on unreliable informants and then police who get involved and take statements that they may or may not know are unreliable.
And then, especially in Michigan now, that's like it's starting to come to light more and more of that problem. I know like the Oakland County prosecutor, I read where in Oakland County now, the police can't use an informant statement without her approving it. So it's coming to light. And I mean, if you would just like look at some of the past exonerations, mm-hmm. and you'll see a pattern. So mm-hmm. Hopefully the more that it comes to light, the more that'll stop it.
So there is a question about this is a fix for your conviction, but have we fixed the system so that doesn't happen again? In Oakland County, apparently they're taking steps. I want to get to that issue and that question. Can you stay for a few minutes?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, when we come back, when we see these convictions overturned, does it lead to a reformation of the process so that innocent people aren't convicted again and again? Does the system reform itself when we have these conviction integrity units going to work? We'll explore that next on JR Morning at 8:49. It was over 10 years ago. Two people died in a house fire that investigators said was intentionally set by a family member, that there'd been an argument the night before. And Dwayne Williams was charged and convicted with felony murder and arson. Spent 11 years in prison. Well, now that, under the auspices of a judge, that conviction has been vacated because of a series of flaws unearthed by the State Appellate Defender's Office. We're joined by Dwayne and the attorney from the State Appellate Defender's Office that led to this conviction being overturned. Milo, I got to ask you, obviously we've got a number of counties now that have these conviction integrity units that do these important look backs, and when they do find that mistakes were made, my question is, does anything change? Is the system improved so that it doesn't happen again, and are people held accountable?
Well, you know, here in Wayne County, we have one of the oldest conviction integrity units, if not in the country, then in the state. I think in 2017, they opened up, and since then, there have been around 40 exonerations, which is wonderful. There are undoubtedly many more people who are in prison who shouldn't be. And I think that by training people, by first of all, shedding light to the wrongs that have mm-hmm. been done, that's huge, and that does make a difference. Then I know the Conviction Integrity Unit and other departments within the prosecutor's office do training to try to prevent issues like this in the future. But just the CIUs being part of the system is a major reform.
Because the resources are to help people like Dwayne, but also it's still a backstop and a check.
Yes, absolutely. And for someone like Dwayne, there is very little that can be done at the stage in the process that his case was in. But the Conviction Integrity Unit is a new pathway and a new outlet to have the case reviewed and for the prosecutor's office to say, hey, wait a minute, we can't stand by this.
But doesn't mean that there won't be future Dwaynes.
No, I don't think it guarantees that. I mean, the Conviction Integrity Unit is more backward-looking than it is forward-looking. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Certainly, they're concerned about reforms, and I think the whole office over there is doing what they can to prevent situations like this. But they don't control everything. They don't control what the police do. They don't control what the fire investigators do. I mean, there's a lot that has to go right for the system to, you know, get the right person, if you will. And even then, when they do that, what's the appropriate sentence? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of questions and a lot of reforms that we still need. But certainly, we're very grateful that the Conviction Integrity Unit took a look at this one and did the right thing.
When these political candidates say criminal justice reform so generally, what does it mean to you? What could be done to help?
I think that some kind of way, and I don't know how, that integrity has to mean something. So you can have all of these things keep happening over and over and over again, but if nobody does anything to change it, if I don't know if it's going to be training, I don't know if it's maybe getting rid of all of the bad apples. I think that there's in some places, there's systemic problems. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get rid of those systemic problems at the root and change the culture of different entities, not just in Detroit, but all over, then it's never going to change.
And there'll be more Dwayne.
Yeah. Right, right. It has to at some point become not acceptable.
You know, what do you say to those? Because you put in work, Dwayne, when you were sitting there. You were right. Not just sitting in jail. You put in work, you know. So what do you say to others who are wrongfully convicted, who are looking to get a second chance to be released?
You know, what I would say to somebody like that, the people who I felt sorry for the most were people who couldn't read, because I had the ability to go into the law library and figure things out. So educate yourself. Is believe it or not, it's people in prison who would teach you how to read. Prisoners who will help. I've seen it so many times. They'll help you. You just have to help yourself and don't accept your situation. You can do something about it.
Especially if you know that you're wrongfully convicted.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. You have to fight. You have to fight.
And just keep going.
Right. Yeah. Right.
You're 53 years old. You're a young guy.
Yeah. Okay. So, I'll take that. Well, if you give it.
There's some miles. There's some miles on the odometer. But right, okay, you're a young guy at 53. Mm-hmm. What's next?
I really hope that I'll be able to develop a platform and to connect and network with people who fight against wrongful convictions and fight against the wrongs in the criminal justice system and social justice. And I just want to, I really, 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 it's like the fight is kind of over for me, but it's not over because it's too many people in the same situation.
You want to fight for someone else. Right.
Somebody has to help them. Somebody mm-hmm. has to help them. And I wouldn't feel right if I didn't.
What did you do the day that they let you out? I mean, did you celebrate in some way? Was it food? Was it entertainment?
They let me out. They let me out like late at night,
okay,
which is a crazy story. But I want to thank the director of the MDLC, a little prisoner. I thank the director of the MDLC, Police Commissioner Darrell Woods, and I don't even know the chief at the Wayne County Sheriff's Department's name. But I got out late the next day, though. All I've been wanting to do is just sit by some water. And luckily, I have a family member who has a boat, and I was able to go spend time on a boat and just sit at the water and think. That's where I'm going to go when we leave here, probably. I'm going to go just sit on a boat and just relax.
I know that's right.
All right. Dwayne, we're happy for you. We hope that the review of your case will be an objective one. Right. Which is what you didn't get before, apparently,
yeah.
And that they will make a decision that allows you to help other people.
Right, and before we go, if you don't mind, I just want to thank, like, the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, the CIU, and Kim Worthy for the decision that they made and for doing the right thing. I'd like to thank Judge Cobb, Rick Wersey, White Boy Rick. I'd like to thank him. Jim Wahlberg, the brother of Mark and Donnie Wahlberg, because they play at a crucial time. They came in and helped me.
Okay. So, oh, wow. Yeah. Are you looking for a job? Is that something we could help you with?
Yeah.
Would you like to, what would you like to do?
How about a little radio? Yeah. I really would like that. But anything dealing with, I really would like that. Let me keep saying that. Anything dealing with just helping the world be better.
Oh, that's so sweet.
All right.
Well, and I want to thank Ms. Menlo and the State Appellate Defender's Office because they are amazing. She is amazing.
Well, we thank you for getting up early and coming down here to the Fisher Building and being here in person. It's just great to meet both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you
I really
so
appreciate
much.
It. Thank you.
All right. It's an amazing story, and we can just hope that each one of these makes our system a little better for everybody.
Right.
Maybe a little more colorblind,
Lloyd. Yes, right. Definitely.
And maybe, certainly, and but we understand these prosecutors under intense pressure to get convictions. The victim, the alleged victims in these crimes all want justice.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
We just got to find those, and we got to get those scales to balance a little better.
That's
Lady Justice is
not
holding.
Not assume.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have a big day tomorrow. We got a 90-minute debate tonight. It could be, we hope that we'll be more light than heat. But we have seen in the past that might not necessarily be the case. So we'll be here to break it down for you with some of the highlights and some of the lowlights, if there are some, and hope for the best for those that truly are seeking information from these two presidential candidates.
And who knows if we get a decision from the Supreme Court on presidential immunity.
We could. And maybe they won't do a bit of leak out. We got enough of those. Right. Shelby Mechanical needs to go to the Supreme Court.
There's a serious leak, Ron. Go over there to the Supreme Court and fix that with that hydro jetting service. Yeah.
We'll be back bright and early tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. to do it all for you. All Talk is next. And enjoy the weekend. Go out to the Rocket Mortgage Classic. Enjoy some golf out there and take a friend. We'll see you tomorrow at 6. Take care.